I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey everyone, David Kern here. Before we get to this week's episode, I just want to tell you about the Searcy Institute Atrium Program. It's a one-year program that explores the foundations of Christian classical education with online classes and discussions. The Atrium now features 5 different courses, and participants can choose any one course or sign up for multiple courses. These courses include our very own Heidi White, our very own here on Close Reads, talking about classical pedagogy. And then we've got Andrew Kern talking about classical rhetoric, Matthew Bianco talking about Plato's Republic. And then from Wes Callahan, you can choose either the Divine Comedy or the Iliad. So there are great options for anybody who wants to dig into any of these subjects. If you'd like to learn more, head over to searcyinstitute.com/atrium. Again, that's searcyinstitute.com/atrium. And once again, those courses are Heidi White on classical pedagogy, Andrew Kern on classical rhetoric, Matthew Bianco on Plato's Republic, or Wes Callahan on the Divine Comedy or the Iliad. One more time, that link is searcyinstitute.com/atrium. And with that, let's get to this week's conversation. Hello, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Tim McIntosh.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which Tim McIntosh makes faces while you're trying to talk.
I wish you could
and
see
also
this.
On which it was a nostril flare, I would describe it as.
Is exactly what it was.
And this is also a podcast, besides a podcast that Tim McIntosh makes nostril flares at his friends. It is also a podcast on which Tim, his nostril flares, and his friends all talk about Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Are Watching God. Well, in particular, this week, the nostril flares and those three friends will be discussing the final 3 chapters of Their Eyes Were Watching God. We've come to the end.
Good job.
Really good.
It was
David.
More of just like stiff arming a distraction, so much as a
segue.
Right,
that was a good description. Stiff arming a distraction.
It's, you know, sometimes it's like being a parent hosting this podcast. I'm just gonna throw that out there. I had my 5-year-old here at the bookstore with me today, and there were moments when it felt a lot like hosting a podcast in which Tim's
flare.
Being there.
It felt a lot like Tim's nostrils.
Tim, other than the unusual urge to nostril flare, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. I am nearing the end of a huge... I'm nearing the peak of a huge mountain at work, and I think I'm on the backside of that peak, which makes me really happy.
You're on the downside?
Because I'm on the downside, which makes me on the upside, which puts me, my spirits on the upside.
So you're on the literal downslope in this metaphor, which puts you on the metaphorical upslope of your emotional life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay. That was really complex. You should
play
it in a novel.
Complex.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Heidi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm having a great time already. I think this is going to be a good episode. Nostril flares, downside.
Mixed
upside,
metaphors.
Paradoxes.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So we're here to discuss Their Eyes Are Watching God. It being the last episode in which we are going to discuss, like, these are the last chapters. So then next week, that means we're going to do a Q&A. So if you are listening and you would like to get your questions in, you can submit those questions via a couple of forms of media. On the one hand, you can email me. That is david@goldberrybooks.com. Or, of course, you can always post those on the Facebook page. We'll have the thread there. Heidi, would you like to be in charge of starting that thread on the Facebook page?
I love being in charge of things.
Mm-hmm. Power vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Power vacuum. I'll step right in. I'll post that Q&A thread.
All right. Right on.
Extra
Thank
post
you.
It. I'll post
Thank
it hard.
You. All right. Perfect. Well, okay. So you can post your questions there and we'll address as many questions as we can next week. After that, of course, we are going to be diving into Walter Wangerin's The Book of the Dun Cow. That's our next book. So we'll send out an email and then post on the Facebook page as well, the schedule for that. And we'll get that up before the Q&A. So in the next week, you'll see that schedule get posted. I will try to get that up on Friday, August 27th, which is the same day that you'll be hearing this episode. Before we get into the conversation, I also need to apologize because there was a mix-up between Logan and I, and we didn't get the episode up on time, even though we thought we'd got the episode up on time. And so I want to apologize that you didn't get last week's episode when you were expecting to. And, you know, that's it. I'm sorry. Every now and then, mix-ups happen. But, you know, I'm sure you had errands to run or chores to do, and we weren't alongside you doing that. And it's a great thing to suffer through. So I apologize for that. Sorry, was that too sarcastic?
No, I thought you nailed that apology.
Yeah. Well, anyway, No, I'm genuinely sorry. It just kind of, you know, went off.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, it just went off track there. Okay, let's talk about Their Eyes Were Watching God. A lot more happens in these two chapters than I was expecting. And in a way, more happens in these two chapters than happens in the rest of the book. Because the rest of the book is kind of this survey of her life. And then this book, in these three chapters, I guess, we get this emphasis on a very small part of her life. So a lot happens. Tea Cake dies. There's a hurricane. There's a rabid dog. And he bites Tea Cake, and that is part of how Tea Cake dies. So there's a lot that happens. Where do we want to start? Like, I was thinking about it, and I was like trying to come up with a good starting question. And I was kind of at a loss because in some ways this section is very different than the first 17 chapters of this book. It feels almost like a different book in some ways. Tim, do you agree with that? That it feels different than the first part?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would add, it seems like at the beginning of the book, we're going to have a very interior resolution. Now, I'm not saying that the whole book is interior, but it's a very interior resolution is what I was expecting, I think, because of the way that the book was set up. And there is a bit of an interior resolution to the book, but so much of these final three chapters were about external action, a hurricane,
things that happen to them.
Yeah, things that happen to them. Getting bit by a rabid dog, the death of Tea Cake, the trial. And then we kind of go back to interiority, but leading up to that is a whole lot of external action. I thought, and it's funny because I thought that the oncoming hurricane was kind of riveting. It's like, I think she did a really great job of setting up that we know that a hurricane is coming. You know, like we know that the Native Americans have signaled correctly by getting out of town. And we're worried about the community that's in the muck and they're kind of looking the other way. And I, you know, like I felt my pulse increasing. I was really like, I was like, time to get
you
out.
You were tuned into the drama.
To get out. Yeah. And I thought that was a real strength of the book. But I was a little bit surprised and maybe even a little bit confused that Janie's kind of like interior unrest was so prominent at the beginning of the book and just not, it didn't feel like the resolution focused on her interiority. It was there. The last couple pages, I mean, certainly we address it, but I was surprised by that.
Heidi, did you feel that too? Like there's this idea of like the interiority kind of being left at the wayside as the novel concluded. Like Tim said it didn't feel like it resolves. I think I agree with that. Like we were given this sort of sense of what the book was and where the drama was and what we were supposed to feel about it. And then when she kind of leaves Janie's inner life, she then doesn't come back and resolve some of those questions that got asked but she does give us this big, like almost like a dramatic set piece, but at the cost of that interiority.
I'm torn on that. I think I disagree. I think it's more complex and a little more nuanced than that. I think that Zora Neale Hurston's entire point, if there is a moral of the story, which it's not a morality tale, is that happiness is an internal experience. It is directly connected to the development of a voice and a control over that voice. I think that's what happens to Janie. That's her entire journey of the book. I think I did feel that, what you're describing, until the final shift in the last couple of pages, when it turns out that it's been this entire novel has, when we think it's been pulling out of Janie's voice, it's been her voice all along, because we rediscover on the last couple of pages that she is telling the story. All of this is a narration that she's been telling to Phoebe. Mm-hmm. And so when we think her voice is disappearing, it's actually not. The entire thing is her voice. And that's how the novel ends. So, like I said, I think it's a little bit more complex than her interiority disappearing, as much as it is this is an action-packed series of events, and she's dictating that action. And then we're reminded that the whole thing was her voice all along.
You know, that's what I would call a rock solid point. And I totally glossed that. I mean, it's not like I forgot that she was telling the story, but I guess I did forget she was telling the story, even though we kind of go back to that at the end. She's with Phoebe, and the kind of like storyteller voice and her own voice are united again. That's a really good point, Heidi, that I didn't even think about, because we've said over and over in this book, that the goal, that it seems like her kind of like discovering the ability to speak for herself, to be who she is central to this, to the plot. And to your point, what do you know? She's been doing it the whole time.
Right. Well, and I think even with that, there's some complexity and some question marks, because there's many points of the novel that shift perspective, that there's things happening that she, in telling Phoebe, she's either speculating on or she couldn't possibly know, right?
Right.
Like what Tea Cake was thinking when he was thirsty, things like that. And so
we also have the narrator that starts before she ever starts telling the story and then comes after she's ever telling the story.
Right. So I think that there's a lot of complexity around the question of voice and voicelessness and the use of language that is structural and stylistic and also thematic, that, and I think the novel ends with some of those threads unresolved. And I think that strengthens the novel, a novel that's about voice and voicelessness and the ambiguity of voice and the development of voice and the ownership of voice leaves some questions about voice unanswered. I think that's a strength, but I can also see it as a frustration.
So you feel then like the questions that are brought up by the focus on her inner life are resolved at the end. I'm not even saying when Tim and I say it feels like it's not resolved, we're not necessarily saying that makes it like that's a criticism so much as it's just becomes a different kind of book.
Right. I do think that that's true. I think that's fair is a better way of saying it. I think it's fair. I think that if you think about yourself telling a story, most of the time when we're telling an action-packed part of the story, we're not stopping to describe our feelings in the midst of a trauma, right? We're telling this what happened. We're talking about running away from the storm. So I think it felt true to me. It felt like the way that a person would tell a story. And I didn't necessarily miss that interiority piece. I think there's parts of this last section, those last three chapters, that feel a little rushed, particularly the trial. That's the part that felt like, wait, what's happening right now? Like, that just felt rushed. But she also tells us that the trial was rushed. She tells us right away the trial was, it happened fast and they did it that way on purpose. And so kind of makes sense that the description of it would also be rushed. And so I think that there's, like I said, I think there's a lot of complexity and nuance and intentional choices on the part of Zora Neale Hurston that could either, we could either argue it works or doesn't work, but it is intentional.
We should, so when we talk about the point of view, I want to, there's one question I do want to make sure we cover, and I'm just going to say what it is now, but then I want to go back to the point of view. We talked a lot about whether she is gaining autonomy as an individual, and she is, you know, there are these generations of women, particularly these African-American women who have had these different experiences, and the, each person's, each of each woman's previous experience then feeds into the generation that comes after her. And then the question becomes the degree to which that there, she actually achieves any kind of autonomy in her life as she goes through these three different husbands. And then in the end is telling her own, you know, trying to tell her own story. So I want to come back to that. So I just want to put that out there because I feel like we do need to discuss whether she, not, I'm not even talking about like, did Hurston accomplish something here so much as does Janie within this story gain autonomy? Do we think that's what Hurston is suggesting? Not did she do a good job, but is that what she's suggesting? But before we do, I want to continue on this point of view because you're talking about the different layers. So I'm going to see if I can get at what you're saying here kind of in a, by way of the summary of what I'm understanding and see if I'm getting it right. Is that cool? Okay. So, okay. Let me think. We've got our large, should I go bigger picture to smaller picture or smaller to larger?
Big to
small. In
terms
of these points of view. Okay. So big to small, we've got the storyteller who is kind of the overarching point of view and has like a more omniscient sense of things and is talking before and after Janie starts telling her story to Phoebe. So we've got that. And then within that, we have, within the book, we also have Janie telling her story to Phoebe and those points, perspectives. Within that, we also have the particular points of view of characters like Tea Cake or Jody or whoever, that people who she would not have known, been able, you know, she couldn't have possibly known that, and yet the novel gives us those points of view. Is there any other layers here? Because we've got the big one, Janie telling her story, the characters within the story, and they all normally would have varying degrees of omniscience and perspective and points of view and all that. But that, are you saying that the complication comes that where the varying degrees of omniscience in those characters is sort of muddied a little bit, and that's what makes the complications?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. Yeah.
I mean, are there more points of view that you're talking about here besides those three?
No,
those three, I think, levels, yeah, of point of view.
There's things that Janie talks about that she couldn't know unless she was told that she wasn't. So yes.
So then why do we assume that's Janie though? Just because the narrator seems to, I read that as the narrator just kind of stepping in and talking about stuff that Janie was telling.
Right. Well, we can't assume it's Janie, to your point. I think that's right. However, on page 191, it's not told in first person, so we know it's not just Janie's story. Mm-hmm. But on page 191, we have an ending and a break in the middle of the page, mm-hmm. which we don't have a lot of those in the novel, right? So it's intentional. It's structurally significant. So she noticed their final paragraph of the narrative the final sentence of the narrative proper is, and now that she was home, she meant to plant them for a remembrance. And then there's a break. And then Janie stirred her strong feet in the pan of water. The tiredness was gone, so she dried them off the towel. Now that's how everything was, Phoebe, just like I told you. Mm-hmm. Right. So we're left then, the implication, although we're not told, it's implied, is that what we have in preceding this is Janie's point of view. Janie has told this story. However, there's things within this, the narrative, that she couldn't possibly know. And so, like I said, that just makes it a little more complicated. Is it a flaw? I don't know. Is it intentional? I think so. I think, and there's a name for it in the what do they call it? Free indirect. in the essay,
discourse.
Free indirect discourse, which that did make me chuckle a little bit because, you know, like novelists write novels and they make choices. And then later, you know, literary theorists come and put names on things that are just like completely made up, right? Like just constructs.
Some of those theorists were novelists themselves, though, exactly. To be fair.
No, of course that's true. But it is funny to me. And that's maybe my I don't like the academicizing of a novel, and that we try to avoid that on the show. Making things like, here's a name for this, and here, reader, like let me instruct you on how to read this novel. Like the point that we try to make, the three of us, is anybody can read a novel. You don't need to know the names of these things. Just read and enjoy the novel, right? And think about it.
Like, but if you want to know the name, here's what people call it.
It's highlighted as a stylistic intentional choice, this free indirect discourse that we're describing and talking about right now.
Tim, what were you going to say?
I was going to make a joke about Polonius describing the different modes of drama that the players can play in the middle of Hamlet. Dramatical, historical, comical, pastoral. You know, he goes on and it's a really laughable scene because he demonstrates, he's out to demonstrate how smart he is. And the result is he just ends up looking like a buffoon. I mean,
Let it be a lesson to you when you get... Two, when you try to prove how smart you are, you're going to get stabbed.
Yeah, right. You're going to get stabbed while hiding behind a tapestry.
And you deserve it because just don't take a story and make it abstract. It's just enjoy it.
keep talking about Polonius for a while, couldn't we?
Poor Polonius.
So one question, I brought this question up about whether she has ends up getting... You know, she does end up getting some agency. Do you think that that's sort of what the implication is of this form? That because it assigns to Janie a degree of omniscience, which you could also just say is she's taking some liberties as a storyteller. One of those two things. It has to be one of those two. Either she has, whoever's telling that part of the story is omniscient about what happened in TK's head, for example, and when she wasn't on the stage, if you will, or she has to be taking some liberties and telling the story, just kind of telling her version of the story. Is Hurston's choice in giving that to Janie kind of meant to represent a degree of agency achieved by her? You're muted, but you're nodding.
You think so, Heidi?
Well, I just said that's a good question, and I don't know. But I think that it is... I think it is clear by the end of the novel that Janie is... not only has she... discovered a voice, but she demonstrates a remarkable amount of control over how she utilizes her voice. And I think some wisdom in to speak and when to be silent.
You mean as a storyteller or as a character in the story?
No, I mean as a character in the story, as a human agent. I think she has successfully navigated object to agent as a member of one of the most oppressed groups in America. And I think that's I think that is the
admirable
journey.
I
think that's the point. Yeah, and I think that's the point of the novel. I think that's why so many female Black American authors and why so many women really like this story, why it remains a classic. Like it is a story of a woman under extraordinary circumstances who finds her voice, but remains also very complex. It's not a simple story. There's a lot of nuance in this story. There's a lot of opportunity to condemn and judge her that Zora Neale Hurston leaves us. There's a lot of ambiguity in Tea Cake and whether or not he's a good man and deserving of her love. Like there's it is not a simple empowerment fable is what I'm saying. There's a lot of complexity in the journey of this woman's and how she gains her voice and owns her selfhood.
So then by the end, going back to my question that I said I wanted to talk about, you do think that by the end she has achieved the agency that we're supposed to hope that we've been rooting for her to get the whole time?
I do. Yes.
Can you give us some examples of how you see that playing out? I don't ask that because I think you're wrong. I just ask that.
Sure.
Yeah. Can you unpack that, as my college professor used to say?
Yeah, I think that her, I think the storm is really significant. Holds like a, I think it's a brilliant choice for like a problem in this particular novel, because the storm is a force without intent. Right. It has no consciousness and thus no malice and no benevolence to it. And the response that the characters have to this storm, it determines their survival, right? It's not something that can be fought. It can only be endured. And I think that that is what, and I think that that then it becomes symbolic of all of the forces in the story. It seems like in this particular novel, what they're saying is something like disease, like Tea Cake's disease. He dies of something that has no malice and no benevolence. It's an entirely implacable and impersonal force. So is the storm. And I think what Herson is saying is that that is the human journey, right? We treat the hardships that we encounter as though they are like a storm, right? And that cannot then be necessarily overcome as much as they must be endured and then assimilated into that interiority that we were talking about earlier. So I think one of the reasons why we don't have as much of a glimpse into the interiority of Janie's feelings is that part of Janie's empowerment journey is everything, whether external or internal, must be only overcome internally. So she's not going out. She's not an activist. She's not going out, you know, like trying to overcome these forces in her life. Like you don't go out and picket a storm, right? You run away from the storm or you endure the storm. And I think that's a lot of how Janie is encountering the world with her own voice. Now, again, this is something we can judge her for and say, hey, you should be out picketing and be an activist, right? We can respond to that. But part of her empowerment journey is that to Janie, racism, sexism are the same thing to be overcome, to be endured, to be assimilated, to be overcome internally, not externally. And that happiness then is something we choose for ourselves. And I think that one of the ways we see that is in the ambiguity of the men in her life, right? We have Tea Cake, who actually, I mean, he does love her. They have this very strong bond. But as we've said, there's all kinds of red flags about that relationship. And in the end, he tries to kill her. And yet she loves him. Right. So we can look at that as like, actually, you've just remained oppressed and enslaved to the male dominated culture. But to Janie, she's gathering in this horizon. Right. And that's the final image of the novel. The novel opens with the image of going out into a horizon. And the novelist tells us that that's a masculine journey. It's men that go out to conquer. It's women that gather in the horizon and take within and interiorize and dream. And the dream then becomes the reality. And I think that's Janie's journey. And I think that's her empowerment.
I don't even know how to respond to me that.
how little of this book, I mean, to Heidi's point, how little this book deals with kind of like white culture as a power structure. It just sort of takes it for granted. I mean, for me, the court case is the biggest example. Like the closest that Herson comes to issuing a complaint against that power structure is found in the court case, you know, with these, like this white community is making a pronouncement on her actions with regard to Tea Cake, her, you know, innocence or guilt. But even in that, Janie doesn't really offer much of a complaint, you know? It's just taken as, I'm just going to echo what you said, Heidi, it's just taken as a fact, like the storm, like illness. And that surprised me a little bit. Not that, I mean, of course, like, I mean,
it surprised the male activists in the Harlem Renaissance too. They didn't like it.
I bet. Yeah.
They indicted her for that. You're too accepting. You're not resisting enough, right? You're playing to the white stereotypes of Black culture. Mm-hmm. And what she was seems to be saying is, I have a different vision of freedom than you do.
And I think in a way you can kind of make the case, like, the best revenge is not to care. I mean, I don't want to pretend that Zora Neale Hurston didn't care. I think most certainly she did. But it just seems like maybe this story is just like, I'm not going to be preoccupied with the oppressors we all know. I'm going to write my story. And I'm not going to like, and I'm not going to write a juxtaposition story that I kind of like find my identity by juxtaposing myself to like the white powers. No, I'm just going to find my own identity in a different way.
Right. The human journey is an internal one. Janie builds and makes her own happiness through her perceptions of through her perceptions and her relationships and her acceptance. Like, her resistance is in a sense quite passive. She's not an activist, but she's saying, I found love. I enjoyed this man. I didn't try to change him. I loved him. And I've always done what I had to do, but I've always been on my own journey. Alice Walker said about her, and I really liked this quote, and I think it really captures Janie's journey. And Their Eyes Were Watching God, she says, quote, I think we're better off if we think of Zora Neale Hurston as an artist, period, rather than as the artist / politician that most Black writers have been required to be, end quote. This is, I mean, what she seems to be saying is that Janie's journey is a human story. It's not a Black story. And I refuse to be defined by the fact that I'm Black in America. I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to indict it. I'm going to portray it in all of its complexity, because it is the Black characters that turn on her at the end. Right. So this porch communal culture is portrayed as both toxic and enriching. Mm-hmm. Right. And so what she seems to be saying is, I'm not a politician. I'm telling the story of one woman's journey, and all of the forces, whether they're racism, sexism, disease, storms, whether those are the negative ones and also the positive ones, the love of a man who is three men who are actually quite complex and abusive in their different ways. Right. And she chose to love one and reject the others. Like, right. Like this, what Zora Neale Hurston is saying is that Janie's subjective journey and her perceptions and the gathering in of the horizon, rather than going out and trying to build the world, right, to let her own internal world be her true world. The dream is the reality, as she says in the second paragraph of the whole novel, right? When that is Zora Neale Hurston saying, like, this is her voice. This is her empowerment.
So one of the things I think is really interesting is early on in the book, I think I read this book as, like we've talked about it here, it's like the story of her achieving her identity, her voice, her agency. And I think I kind of semi-consciously juxtaposed that goal, like the goal of achieving one's identity or voice, with the idea of becoming integrated with a community. So an example of books that seem to really move toward integration, I think of Wendell Berry's novels as characters who are finding in some way a way to kind of rejoin or reconnect or be integrated with the small farming town in Kentucky that all of his characters are located in. I mean, not universally. I'm not saying that like all of his books are the same, but so often a character who is estranged comes back to the community and is welcomed by the community or even eulogized by the community. So the two kind of alternates, I would say, or maybe the work of Wendell Berry is about reintegration. And I think maybe a book like The Stranger by Albert Camus, which regardless of what you think about Camus, it's a really great book. And it's a story of an individual, like setting himself apart, you know, this is like part of him.
Yeah, I mean, the it is what the book says, the title says.
Right.
It is.
He's the stranger. He's like, he finds the kind of world that he is in illegitimate, and he pays the price for it, but he like deliberately stands apart. Okay. So those are kind of like this kind of a...
Maybe we should do some Camus sometime.
I would love to do some Camus. I wonder what our, I don't know what our listeners would think about it, but it could be fun. Anyway, these are
they might appreciate us doing
modes of thinking about how like maybe like redemption happens for a character. And it seems like this book doesn't really fit neatly into either one of them. You know, it's not Janie like just coming to stand apart. I mean, so much of the joyful moments in this book are her being like integrated, like being welcomed after kind of being an outcast as a trophy wife. She is integrated into like the party that is just wonderful that is happening in the muck. But it's also, that's not the whole story that's being told. There's also this kind of individualizing with her. And so I think I had a hard time at the beginning of the book, like really placing where she was going to go. And I think part of the reason I had a hard, part of the reason I thought this is a story chiefly about identity as a, like, as juxtaposed with a community is the gossiping women that are kind of nattering at the beginning of the story who don't like her, who like are telling who she is and they have a terrible opinion of her. That's part of the reason why I thought we were going to get a story that was not her integrating, because who would want to integrate with them? Like nobody would want to be like part of that community, you know? But that's not what we got neither one of those. So what you're saying, Heidi, is really helping me kind of make sense of this kind of, it's almost like a middle position between integration and individualization.
In the afterword, Henry Louis Gates talks about the way the writers of her generation thought about this book. And of course, he's one of the, in the 80s, he was one of the reasons that this book continued to gain more popularity and respect within, certainly within, you know, academic realms. And he talks about how, you know, you had Richard Wright, Ellison, Hurston, you know, there were other black writers of the era. And he says that they were engaged in a battle over ideal fictional modes with which to represent the Negro. And clearly Hurston lost the battle, says Henry Louis Gates. Although he says she didn't lose the war, because you know, people like Alice Walker and Toni Morrison then rediscovered her 30 years later. But what we're seeing, that the important, to me, the most important point of all that is that they're in this era when they are trying to do exactly what Janie is trying to do for herself. They are trying to identify the best modes to express their cultural heritage, like to express who they are and what their heritage is, and to figure out how to take that heritage into the future. So they're debating like, and experimenting with different modes of expressing that heritage and sharing their culture with the wider culture. And so she's kind of offering one foray, Richard Wright's offering one foray with Native Son and Black Boy and Ellison with Invisible Man. And, you know, there were others, and this is not Hurston's only novel. And so she's kind of, they're all trying to figure out how do we carve out this voice, which is exactly what we're asking, what Janie's trying to figure out for herself. And her grandmother has one approach to that. And as Janie's life goes on, she kind of rejects her grandmother's way of thinking about things. But then ironically, at the end, ends up sitting on the porch, which is, you know, she rejects the idea of sitting on the porch because she says, well, once you get on the porch, what are you going to do? But then at the end of the novel, that's what she's doing. She's sitting on the porch. And so like what Hurston then says in response to Richard Wright is, I'm trying to figure out how to write the black novel. I think that she says, I'm trying to write the black novel, not a novel of sociology. So on the one hand, I think she definitely accomplishes that. And it allows us as readers, you know, we can read the book on its own terms, right? It allows us as readers to not worry about, to Heidi's point, the sociological studies that we could drum up out of this book, right? It allows us to say, well, how does this book work as a novel? You know, like we can look at it from a formal perspective, because that's what they're all trying to do, is they're trying to figure out what is the best way formally to carve out a voice for ourselves in a world that rejects our own voice. And so this book mirrors that struggle that all of these Black writers and all of the Black artists of the Harlem Renaissance, the musicians, the painters, the sculptors that made up one of the most incredible and creative eras of art in like American history. And so there, the book mirrors that struggle that all those artists were having. And so in that way, I think it's like really consequential, you know, really important. And like helpful to read it that way, to understand it almost as like a mirror of what Janie is like a mirror. Janie as a person is like a mirror of all these artists, of Zora Neale Hurston herself, trying to figure out what is the best form of expressing who I am and who we are. I think that's pretty compelling. And I think her response to Wright is fair. I also think that you could make a case that what Ellison and Wright are saying is fair too, but they're looking at the world in different ways, you know, like they can both be fair. I don't think that they would like, we live in a world where when you like criticize somebody or ask somebody a question about something, it's like you're doing harm to them. But I think what was happening is you had all these characters all these writers who were trying to figure out this way of expressing themselves. And so they were kind of going back and forth at each other. And I think they had a lot of respect for each other. And so they weren't arguing about it on Twitter, mercifully.
And also the movement is, it's nascent and it's relatively small. I mean, and so.
You mean the Harlem Renaissance?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. And so.
You know, it became understood very differently 100 years later. Yeah. We think about it differently now than it was in the moment that it was happening. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean?
That's not what I was. I mean, that's true. That is true. I was just going to say, I think at this point, the Harlem Renaissance is a relatively, it's a group of people that know each other, and it's relatively small. And so conversations about what is the Black novel going to be like? Well, you could have that community trying to achieve a singular answer instead of multiple answers. Mm-hmm. You could have this kind of book and this kind of book and this kind of book. So to your point, David, I think Richard Wright might say, I think that the African-American novel should be chiefly concerned with political and cultural protest. And Zora Neale Hurston can say, no, I think it's about something different. And there's room enough. I mean, especially now, there's room enough for both of those answers. But I just wonder if at the time it didn't feel in that community that there was room enough for both answers. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
One of my favorite literary things to think about and read is like these schools that emerge. So you've got these folks during this era who are trying to say, well, what is the American Black novel going to be? Like, we're living in Jim Crow South. We're carving out this voice for ourselves and this sort of school of literature is difficult. You know, you've got at almost the same time, you've got like the American expats in Paris, the Fitzgerald, Hemingway, that school. And they're like trying to figure out, what is their school of novel? Like, how are we going to change American lit? You've got like the Inklings, right? At one time, they're the famous school. You've also got like the bright young things in England, the WAS, and you know, I think Nancy Mitford's part of that. I'm just fascinated by the way those, like these schools of people who know each other emerge, and what they're all trying to do is figure out, how do we share our story and who we are in this particular time? Because they're living a particular experience at a particular time that is fraught in its own particular ways. And so as they're trying to figure out how to express that, they're all kind of doing that in different ways. And sometimes it feels like they're competing with each other, and sometimes it feels like there's like this synchronicity between them. But I just think it, like, the whole thing is fascinating to think about and watch how those things emerge.
And you can see how tempers would flare if Richard Wright thinks, man, Zora Neale Hurston, you're living in Jim Crow South and you're not going to really talk about it that much. You're not going to like actually acknowledge like the elephant in the room. And I think that she would, I have no idea how she would reply. And I'm sure that she did reply. But I think that she might say, I'm going to venture to say that she might say something like, I'm not ignoring the elephant in the room. I totally acknowledge like the shape of things in Jim Crow South. I think the best way to deal with it is to write a story that is not so preoccupied with that reality so as to make it the most powerful character in the book.
Right. I mean, she does, you're exactly right. She does respond to those accusations and makes a very strong claim on what she was trying to do. She says outright, I want to portray Black culture as full, robust, and complex. And in her words, undiminished, although fraught by the surrounding white culture.
Right.
She's saying,
on.
If you only portray Black culture as being oppressed by a white majority, then you are not understanding the richness and the complexity and the community and the goodness of it. I will not, she's saying, I will not allow our people to be defined only by whiteness and oppression. We have undiminished culture. That's what
she
said.
Do you think she accomplishes that? That's what we have to then respond. That's what she's asking us to think about.
Right. And she's saying, here's what she's saying then. And I think this novel is a great, great example of this. To your point, David, that you made earlier, which I thought was brilliant, is that Janie then bears on her shoulders the entire kind of statement that Hurston is saying about Black culture. And what she's doing here is shifting the field of action from the external to the internal through Janie's journey of finding her voice. That's all.
And were you, Tim, you were going to say something too, right?
No.
And for Heidi White and for Tim McIntosh.
That's the show. Welcome.
Yeah, that life and identity and happiness are internal processes, not external. They're not defined by oppressors or they are defined by our own choices as individual humans in a big, implacable world that's fraught with storms.
Okay, let's talk about, we could have a long discussion about whether we think she accomplished what she claims to have set out to do. Does she portray what she's trying to portray effectively? But let's talk about the storm and Tea Cake's death.
Can I say I totally came
unless you
I totally came around on Tea Cake. By the end I was like, oh man, I love Tea Cake. I love Tea Cake. And at the end,
it's funny how she sets you up at the beginning to think that he's going to be terrible, like the worst of all.
Right. You're like, oh man, we're in it again. We trusted Tea Cake and now you took all of our money. But by the end, man, I love him.
But the reason we love him is because she loves him. Because I still think there's a case to be made that he has.
Tim, what do you love about him? What brought you around?
He was with his woman till the end. You know,
and loyalty.
I think he loses his mind. He gets rabid and he loses his mind, you know. But I don't think that anybody's supposed to get out of this novel that he actually like turned against her. No, he was rabid. And so I think while he was still in his good mind, I think he loved her. I think he was crazy about her. Yeah, he had his foibles. Well, totally.
He talks a lot about how, you know, she's beautiful and he's complicated.
He's complicated.
Sometimes he shuts her up and sometimes he gives her voice. Sometimes he, you know, hides her away and sometimes he shows her off. I guess that's kind of the point.
You know what I should say?
He seems a little bit of a cipher to me, but
I think I appreciated him more as a character than for his relationship to Janie. Like his relationship with Janie was fraught, but as a character, well drawn, I loved him. I loved him. And I do think that his kind of loyalty and affection for her came out at the end.
And it does help that we, you know, in comparison to these other two guys who we don't get as much time with, we're able to see the complexity that's in him. Whereas we don't really get a ton of complexity with the other two guys. Yeah. Like, so Hurston doesn't spend as much time revealing their inner lives.
We get a little bit about Joe Starks, not much at all from Logan. Yeah. Logan's just...
Right. It's, I mean, it's increasingly... flat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not, to be fair, not the person who edits our podcast.
That Logan is very complex. I feel like sometimes he doesn't listen enough to me, but still... He's really complex.
Listen, the reality is that in the end, the person who masters and edits the episodes is the one with the power. He's the one with the power.
And he's so constantly listening to you.
We should just understand that.
He's literally listening to us. Literally. All the time. Logan, you're a hero. We love you.
I did lose track of what... Were you going to say something? Because you did unmute yourself, but it may have been to just laugh at...
It was to laugh. I wanted our audience to know that I was laughing at Tim in a very respectful kind of way.
What did you think of Tea Cake at the end, Heidi?
I liked him, but I think that he's not perfect, and I think that's great. And I keep going back to, it's like, this novel could have been a very flat, boring, identity fable. Right. Perfect Janie overcomes all of the problems in the world and finds the perfect man. And then, tragically, melodramatically has to, kill. Like, Hurston could have written a much lesser story. And it would have been probably quite tempting to do so. Right. But she didn't. Like, she let him be quite complex. Like, the fact remains, he beat her up. Right. And then we get this like really interesting and I think cool detail in the storm chapter about how they left a motorboat behind and he fell asleep. And then he actually survived the storm. But because Tea Cake was in such a hurry to get away, then he ends up dying. Right. He causes his own death. Like he goes out and but he does it through trying to save Janie because of his great love for her. Right. So there is, I think that there is quite a lot of complexity and richness of detail in this section that kind of contributes to the complexity of Tea Cake. But yeah, I thought he was awesome because, and I think the most compelling thing about him is Janie's love for him.
Yeah. Like I said, any affection we have for him is because she has affection for him.
Again, it's that interior world of Janie that influences our perception as readers of
She's
the external
the
world. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the end, is she better off without him?
No.
Does she have rabies at the end? He bites her.
I think the doctor is supposed to have... I took it like the doctor gave her medicine.
Maybe so.
Have you guys ever heard the This American Life episode about the girl who had rabies because she got bit by a bat?
No.
So
rabies seems
they figured out. Yeah, well, like you can go online and like listen to recordings of people who have had rabies before they die because it scrambles your brain, and so you basically shortwire. And so, what this girl got bit, she started getting sick. And this doctor theorized a way to save her. So he put her into a coma, like a medically induced coma. And then the infection scrambled her brain, but her brain, they were able to shut her brain down enough So eventually they were able to like watch the brain activity. And so they saw it like going crazy and she's in a coma. And so then they were able to get her through that. And then when she woke up, she was fine.
Right. Cause most rabies patients die of thirst because they can't swallow. I went and drank like 6 glasses of water after I read this section, by the way. I'm like, I do not have rabies.
Well, the ironic thing is like, there's a flood and also he can't drink. Right? Like,
so that, yeah. So I think that whole section made me never want to ever get rabies. For
no
sure.
Doubt.
Yeah, I don't encourage that.
I didn't want to get rabies, but this really reinforced that. So
they do have like medicine you can give that.
So maybe
if you
she
get
doesn't.
It quick enough, it's like a rattlesnake bite.
I kept waiting, like he bit her. And so I'm like,
she's fine way later.
Yeah.
When she's telling the story, she's fine.
But it took him 3.5 weeks, right? It was like 4 weeks until he got sick and she buries him and then goes back home. And so I was like, maybe there's just like rabies waiting.
Heidi, she's fine. She's fine, Heidi. She's fine. Okay. She's totally fine.
Thank you.
She's okay.
I really needed to hear that.
Speaking of, is she okay? I asked, in the end, is she better off without him? Because one of the big questions of the story is like her agency, her voice.
I think he changes. I think he grows up a little bit.
They really love each other.
One of the things the story seems to be asking is like, she has independent agency, independent voice in a way that she never did before, but she doesn't have.
But she doesn't have TK.
Love. She doesn't have the relationship.
That's the cost, right? Because there is a line in the book that mirrors the line in All the Pretty Horses, in which there's a claim that the gods require blood, right? I think the loaded gun image is the most brilliant thing in the whole book. When she takes the two shells out of the first two chambers, so he gets two shots at her. That was brilliant.
Yeah.
Right. So she's not going to shoot him until she knows that he really is really trying to shoot her. So she gives him two empty rounds. And on the third round, you know, before he fires the third round, she shoots him. And I think that loaded gun is marriage in the book. Right. Cause she gets two empty two empty shots of failed marriages. But then the third one almost kills her until she kills it.
Wow.
I was like reading that and I'm like, this is a brilliant image of the loaded gun. So I think the gods have required, and that's the whole title, right? Their eyes were watching God. It's the bystanders to the flood who are doing nothing to save themselves. And here comes the flood, right? And so God has this, religion's not a big thing in the book. I kept waiting for it because of the title, you know? But religion doesn't seem to be any kind of defining force, any memorable community force, nothing kind of like gathering around the idea of faith. Mm-hmm. And there's almost this like pagan or even like an animistic view of God, right? Like the supernatural conflated with the natural, the storm represents God, right? These implacable forces of nature that have no malevolent or benevolent intent. And that seems to be mm-hmm. the best that we get when we're talking about God. And yet there's that really strong statement that the gods require blood. And so she has to trade in her lover for her voice and her identity. Hmm. Hmm.
Well, we need to work our way to the end here. We do have the Q&A episode, so make sure that you send in your questions either to david@goldberrybooks.com or on the thread that Heidi is going to start.
Mm-hmm. That's my job.
Over on the Facebook page. It's your job. Okay, let's do final thoughts.
I am really glad that this book was part of the Close Reads season. It's like one of these books that it's been on my list forever and it's never risen to the top. And I'm glad that the podcast was the reason it like got to the top and then we read it. And I'm really glad that I read it. And I'm really glad that I read it with you. It's like one of those occasions. It's like, oh man, I got a lot more out of this book because Heidi and David were in my ears.
It's so unlike, after the book of the
logo, I wish that he listened to me.
Well, he wouldn't be in your ear then. It would just be him responding to you being in his ear.
That's great. Okay, great. Just juxta. Okay, take his side, David. Take Logan's side.
Oh, I'm always going to take
his
side.
You're always taking Logan's side.
He can make us seem so bad.
You never listen to me.
You know what? This whole episode, you're going to sound like one of those, like, your voice is going to sound all weird and like one of those.
I know. He's going
to mice in the song.
Wouldn't it be funny if the whole show is me talking in a Mighty Mouse voice?
What are those? Is it Mighty Mouse? What's that song where the little mice sing?
The Alvin and the Chipmunks?
Yeah. You know, my wife can do that so
really?
Well. She does that and it sounds just like them. She won't do it in public. And it's one of the great tragedies.
She wouldn't do it for hire me.
Because it's hilarious. I don't know. She barely does it for me. Okay. So, after the Book of the Dun Cow, we're going to be discussing A Gathering of Old Men by Ernest Gaines, which is another novel by a black author that's going to be talking about the black experience. And it's going to be, you know, the continuation of carving out what the Black American novel is. So that's going to come after the Book of the Dun Cow. But Gaines was a close friend of Wendell Berry. They studied together. And so it's interesting that you brought up Berry, Tim, because he's going to be kind of a similar vibe to Berry in some ways, but also approaching some of the questions that these writers from the Harlem Renaissance had. So that'll be interesting to touch on in a couple of weeks. Heidi, final thoughts. We'll call that my final thought.
Okay, so my final thought is a question, and I'm going to post it on my own Q&A thread for you guys to answer because I don't know. I could not figure out why there was never any question of children in this novel. There's no church and there's no children. And that both of those things were very intriguing to me because in a novel that explores community, to completely remove as any kind of factor at all, church and children, that is quite
interesting.
Interesting, and it seems a very intentional removal because those, like the passing on of culture and faith culture, have always been defining characteristics of all cultures. And she's an anthropologist. And so it seems intentional, and I can't figure out why.
And it's not like it's not a part of.
And there's no question, like it's not Janie and the men in her life never seem to ask why Janie never had kids. Like to me, I'm not bothered by the fact that she didn't, but why is that not any kind of preoccupation of the novel?
And
why is there such a marked absence of faith in a book that has God in the title?
Great question.
Thanks.
So we'll need some people that are listening to answer that one.
I wish I had a podcast in me that answer my questions about this novel. So
I wish.
All right. Well, we have hit our time limit. Let's go ahead and wrap it up. Let me just say again, David@goldberrybooks.com, a thread on the Facebook page. And after this is the Book of the Dun Cow schedule being sent out Friday, August 27th. So with that, for Heidi White, for Tim McIntosh, for Logan Green, who doesn't listen to Tim, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, happy reading.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.